These two glasses up here disturb me. So one's going down in case I spill, it won't be quite so bad. Good morning, everybody. My name is Mildred, and I'm Mildred Frank. I'm from Toronto, Canada. My home group is the Rocks Glen Traditional. My dry date is May the 18th, 1973, and I am doing not step four and not step two, but step three. Hi. Did I not say that? Well, yes, I'm an alcoholic, and I think by the time I get finished, you'll be very well aware of that. Thank you, Dick and Barbara, for all the work that you put into this. These Woodstocks are fabulous, and I love them, too, because it's a great opportunity to be with some of the people that I consider my mentors. You're sitting, some of you in the front row, some of the speakers who are here, and some of my very good friends. It's also wonderful to be with the rest of you. And so thank you for coming. Thank you for being here this morning. In the 12 and 12, in step 10, Bill writes, he describes the way we come here. He says, we loved but a few. We were indifferent to the many, so long as they caused us no problems. And we hated the rest. That kind of describes me, but not quite. Because I was not selective. I loved nobody, and I hated everybody indiscriminately. And my soul, when I came here, was at war. It was at war with God. It was at war with myself. It was at war with you. It was at war with the way I thought the world worked. Other than that, everything was lovely. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous the first time in 1966, and I saw step three, I thought, you've got to be kidding. You've got to be kidding. What I know about spirituality and God and so on, and you want me to make a decision that I'm going to turn my will and my life. And the awful part of it was I had absolutely no relationship to what those words might mean. You know, we can have a belly full of booze, but you know what? We can also have a head full of theology. And a head full of theology doesn't fix the belly full of booze. I can tell you that. Today, how is it with me? Today, I would say step three is the center of my spiritual life. It's the center of my AA life. Things have changed in 37 years. Because I think that's what we come here for. Things I read in the big book where it says, and I've come to believe this today, that we have been rocketed into the fourth dimension. I believe that God is everything. And today it is significant to me when on page 164 it says, see to it that your relationship with God is right and great things will come to pass. So you see, a lot has changed in my life. I know the darkness of living from self, and I also know the joy and the peace that come from living in God consciousness, you see. And that is really what I'm here to talk about, and Dick gave me instructions. He said, I think it would be very interesting to see how an ex-nun comes to practice step three. So, I sweat over that a bit, and but you know, Bill says it. He says there's a price to be paid. It's the destruction of self-centeredness. And that is really what my story is all about. And I'll share a bit of it with you. My life really revolves around my sister, Dora. Dora was born, and she was injured at birth, and they called her retarded. And my parents were not educated people. They didn't know what to do. This is many, many years ago. The school system didn't know what to do, and they kept her in grade 3 till she was 16. Why is this important to me? Because I was the last of 10 children to be born. I was 3 and she was 16. And I don't care who you are, you need comfort. And she came to me. She cried, she'd come to me and she'd crawl into my bed and she'd cry. I'm 3 years old. I love her. And it became my mission in life. This crying has got to stop. So I tried to stop it. I tried to comfort her. She continues to cry. I've got 8 big brothers and sisters who love me. I go to them and I say, you've got to do this, you've got to dance with Dora, you've got to, you know, I had it all figured out at 3 years of age. And nothing changed. And if you had taken a 2x4 and smashed me across the back, it wouldn't have hurt me. I understand now that in those formative years, we suck up all kinds of ideas. The ones I sucked up were, nobody cares about me. If they did, if they really cared about me, they'd fix the situation. You see, I was a child in a world where we didn't have Oprah, we didn't have Maury Povich. We didn't have all kinds of opportunities to, or whatever, you, if you consider it an opportunity, to get on television and spread your guts to the whole world. We didn't talk about this. And so I made my own conclusions, you see. I made the conclusion that life is scary, nobody cares about me, and that's the way I lived. I became a child who manipulated. I became a child of despair. Maybe I came to the planet that way. I don't know. I was an angry child, and I was afraid. I didn't say anything. I kept that all inside. And I have to tell you, you become very twisted when you're smiling on the outside and you're dying on the inside. And you're blaming the family that you have because they're not fixing it. Now, what's that got to do with step 3? It's got everything to do with step 3. Because there's another player in this piece. We were Roman Catholic and we went to church. And everybody in my community went to church. And I heard something there. I heard the priest say that God was love and God was power. And I had my answer. I knew. If God is love and God is power, I'm just going to tell him what's going on and he's going to fix it and it's all going to be okay. And you know what happened? Absolutely nothing. And I remember sitting on the woodpile with my cup of homebrew looking at the beautiful sunsets in Saskatchewan. Anybody know where Saskatchewan is? Oh, this is good. One of you married a girl from Saskatchewan. And Clancy has been there many, many times. And I couldn't figure it out. How can a God that can make sunsets and at night the aurora borealis dance across the sky, and he can do that, but he can't fix one little person and help her to stop crying? And I became confused. I didn't shut God out of my life because he was the best thing I had going for me. That family sure wasn't going to fix things. And then at 5, I took a drink. And, you know, I'm not going to go into a big, long drunkalogue because I really want to talk about step 3 and about the stubbornness that kept me from experiencing peace for a long time because I thought I saw the world right. And if you didn't see it the way I saw it and didn't do what I wanted, I hated you, I manipulated you, I did all kinds of things. But very seldom did I tell the truth because I thought you won't like me if I tell you what I'm really thinking about you. So I picked up that drink. My father made homebrew and I took some of this homebrew and I drank it and it was all really wonderful. And, you know, Clancy described it last night. That is what got out of it. The world went away. The bad world went away. I could handle Dora. I didn't have those bad feelings anymore. Suddenly, I felt love for people, and I was sure everybody loved me. The problem was the feeling would go away, and I needed more booze. Now, I know when you're five, you know, I'm sure I was an alcoholic the very first drink I took. I come from a family where there's alcoholism. And that's all I really thought about for the next 35 years. Who's got the booze? How am I going to get it? When are we going to drink it? Where are we going to drink it, etc. I didn't have to be taught how to steal booze. I didn't have to be taught how to lie about things. And there isn't much that I haven't done for a drink, I can tell you that. When Tony was talking the other night about drinking vanilla, I remember those days, the vanilla days and the Chanel No. 5 days. Whoa, they both got quite a kick. And Tony said it was a man who asked her if she smelled like cookies. In the convent one night, Mother Superior said to the housekeeper, did you bake cakes today? And the housekeeper said, no. And Mother Superior said, well, you must have. She said, I smell them. Well, what she really smelled was me huffing in the corner. At 18, I decided to go to a convent because by 18, you see, the other piece of my family is I didn't feel okay there. Nobody hurt me. They loved me. I know that. But it was my perception of what was going on there. They were all much older than me. I was like the exclamation point at the end of that big Catholic family. And you weren't the only distributor. And I didn't fit with them. By the time I was five, they were dancing and partying, and they had their friends, and they were, you know, getting engaged and all that kind of stuff. I didn't fit there. And one more time, I learned the world is a scary place. So at 18, I decided to go to a convent, and I'm not going to get into a big story about that, but I could. When you don't fit, where do you go? I wanted really to be a lawyer. My father said, go. I was scared. I was scared to leave home because that's the other thing. I felt nobody helps me when I've got a problem. So I decided I'm going to go to a convent. And I think somewhere in the back of my mind, I had the idea they have to love me. And I'm going to be part of something. I can tell you, you can be part of a whole lot of people. You can be part of a whole group and feel like an absolute outsider, just like I did when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous. We have a motto in the front of our room, and it is, you are no longer alone. Well, I can tell you when I came in, I hear people say, I felt I was right at home. I did not. I felt as isolated as I had ever felt. But I went to that convent because I had plans for God. See, if I go to a convent and I do this thing I don't want to do, then you, God, are going to have to make the world. You've got to fix me. You've got to fix Dora. And then we'll go on the rest of the world. We'll get things straightened out. That was my plan. I entered there drunk. Nobody would take me in Saskatchewan. I tried four or five convents, and they just laughed and said, you don't belong in a convent. Our pastor said, you don't belong in a convent. Tell me I can't, and I'll show you I can. And so I know where the swinging convents are. They're in the States. I wanted a swinging convent. None of this crap that I had seen in the high school where I went to school. So I wrote to the States, and finally somebody wrote me back and said, we have a convent in Ontario. Why don't you write them? And I did. And sight unseen, they took this alcoholic. I went there that night. I was as drunk, I could hardly walk. And they took me anyway and inducted me into the convent that very night. And so began this illustrious 15 years of drunkenness within a convent. Trust me, people say, how can you stay drunk in a convent? Are you an alcoholic, if you ask that? If I had to, I'd stay drunk on top of a telephone pole. I'd find a way. And, you know, I used to make sure I always had the jobs in church, because if I overserved myself, I could go sleep it off in the confessional. I know confessionals weren't made for that. But anyway, it served my purposes. After 15 years, we had a very enlightened Mother Superior, and she called me, and we decided that I should leave. Or she said, you know, I don't think you belong here. And, you know, as it turns out, she knew all about my drugging and my drinking. Didn't know what to do with me. So we wrote to Rome, and I got my dispensation. And, you know, what did those 15 years bring me? Did they bring me to step three? Not at all. You know, I was in there for a purpose. Step three is not about me. It's not about my purpose. It's about doing the things that are going to enable me to be of service on the planet and to do what God would have me do. I didn't know that, you know, so the 15 years there were wonderful in one sense. I had opportunities for studying. I had opportunities for music. I had opportunities for all kinds of things. And I never blamed the nuns. It wasn't their fault that I came there crazy and left crazier. I remember standing on the convent steps January the 10th, 1966. And I thought my problems were over. I was a well-educated young woman, and I knew nothing. I had a head full of all kinds of stuff, and not one essential truth did I know, that the problem was inside me, and that I had to get right with God, and that it wasn't about trying to force God to do my will, but that would turn around. But I was sure I was okay. What I didn't know was that I was to embark on a... It was like, I try to find words to describe this, because as soon as I had my secular clothes, I was no longer Sister Mary Eugenia. I was dispensed from the vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. You play around with those anyway as needed. And, but I was dispensed from them now. And I thought, there's a man out there that's going to find me. And he's going to put diamonds on me, and I'm just going to say, we're going to sail into the sunset. What happened was, I found the bar. I had to drink. And now, I'm a secular again, and I don't know. We talked about that last night. I don't know how to do secular life. I'm scared. I'm all the things that, and here I go down to the bar. I don't have to read you a big story to tell you what happened. I found the booze, I found the men, and I became a woman of degradation. I was out of the convent 3 weeks, and the police put me in jail. That should tell you something. You are sick. Watch this one. I don't ever, ever, ever want to feel that dirty and full of degradation again. And so I signed myself into an insane asylum. And my family hadn't heard from me, so my brother came and he found me there. And he took me to the west, to where my home is. And I went to Saskatoon to the university hospital. By this time, I had been locked up 32 times in mental institutions, psych wards, and insane asylums. I had had 38 electroshock treatments. And it isn't the Thorazine shuffle, but it will do. I had been tied to the bed on numerous occasions, and it wasn't for Good Time Charlie. I had had straight jackets on. I had enough of that. I'd had hundreds of hours of therapy, and I'm telling you, you know, I understand what this program is about, or I accept, I should say, I accept what this program is about. It is the worker of miracles. It is God's vehicle for doing for us what we can't do for ourselves if we'll just let that happen. You know, I learned, I too often would go onto the stage with one of the recurrent psychiatrists, and the students would be in the audience, and we would discuss, you know, what made me the way I was. A lot of hogwash. Anyway, Dr. Hoffer was in that hospital. So was a man named Dr. Frank. I married him. Dr. Hoffer was a friend of Bill Wilson. He knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. And he knew about, you know, my file that thick, and he said, this is not what this woman is about. She's alcoholic, she should go to AA. Now, I've got a brother who died 49 years sober. And my father had phoned me, and he said, your brother has been transformed. He said, there's a miracle in our family. Because when I left home, they were saying he's going to die, and nobody knew. It was his stomach, it was his whatever. My father said, this wonderful thing has come to the Prairies. They call it Alcoholics Anonymous. And my father started to cry. He said, it's so good, because it had saved the life of his son. And I remembered that when Dr. Hoffer said AA, I was ready to go. So November 15th, 1966, off I went to my first meeting. And I was waiting to be transformed. This is going to be good. I'm going to be transformed, and then everything's going to be okay. Don't ask me to do step three. Do not ask me to turn anything over. Do not ask me to do what somebody else wants. You fix me, and I'll be yours. I'll do whatever you want. Then we'll have a way to talk. I waited 3 weeks, and I liked it. And then I didn't like it anymore. Because I'm the person full of self. I'm self-obsessed. I can only think about me and what I want and the way the world should go. And now I don't have booze. I have no medication to change the way I feel, and I couldn't stand it. I'm not leaving AA, not at all, because my dad said you get transformed here. My dad liked AA, so I'm going to stay, but I can't stay, so I've got to not drink, but I know how to change how I feel. So I sat in a 5.5 years stoned. Those were the years when Chuck Chamberlain used to come to Prince Albert a lot. West Parish used to come a lot. And I think about the kindness, you know, I'm stoned, I can't remember my own name hardly, and they take the time to sit with me and talk to me and try to get me to see. One thing I remember, I found some notes from those days. Chuck had said, you already are everything you can be. How would you like to hear that when you've got a belly full of pills? Yeah, that really moved me. And he would draw that circle, and he'd say, there's only one of us here. I didn't understand it, but he was kind to me. And another one that was so kind was Wes Parrish. I couldn't hear what Wes said, but I felt the power of his spirit. And another one who really moved me was Mac Cheater. Oh, my God, he was a fabulous human being. You missed it if you missed Mac. And I couldn't stay sober, and I couldn't stay there The last year and a half I drank. My husband, you see, was alcoholic too, and he started to drink. And when you've got two people like us drinking, it doesn't take long for all hell to break loose. We lost our house, we lost our cars, we lost our fancy lifestyle. And the last 3 weeks that I lived in drunkenness, I was on a park bench. I had a little suitcase, I still remember it, little suitcase and little plastic bag, that's all I had left. The sheriff had locked the door and there was nothing left. Morning of May the 18th. You know, and all that, the thing about that was, never struck me, something's wrong with you, Mildred. It's wrong with the world. That's why I'm where I am. And so DTs didn't stop me. I had six convulsions. You don't want one. I can tell you, you don't want six. I'd wake up in places where I didn't know where I was. I didn't know who I was with. I wouldn't know how I got there. And life was scary. And then I woke up in a psych ward. And there were two men sitting at the foot of my bed, and they really were there. And and on May the 18th, 1973, the police had picked me off this park bench and panhandling and God knows what. And the morning of the 20th, I made up my mind, I'm going to kill myself. What had I done of any value? You see, I think this program is God's activity, and I think you said it yesterday, Polly, or Linda said it too. God offers his gifts to all of us. I don't think this is an unmerited gift, you know, because if it's unmerited, then there must be gifts that are merited. And I don't believe that. If God is everything, then everything is gift. And if we open our souls to it, it flows. It's that simple once you see that. But I didn't see that at the time, and I decided to take my life. And that was, I was out of plans. And I'm telling you, if you've got a problem and you're out of plans, you're in a special place. As long as I've got my stirring spoon in there, God can't do much with me because I'm going to screw it up. And I didn't know how to do step three, and I wouldn't do step three. I didn't pray that morning, but what I did know was I'm out of plans. And so it was as if a giant hand reached into me and took from me the compulsion and the obsession. I'm 37 and a half years sober, and in 37 and a half years, I have never, it's gone, it's clean. And that morning when I stood there, I knew it was gone. And I remember, I didn't know what had happened. I sure didn't see it as a spiritual gift. I just knew, I don't have to drink anymore. But I said, I don't know. I don't know how to live sober. You'll have to, whatever you are, you'll have to send me somebody. And there was a rap on the door. Honest to God, that happened. And this man stood there and he said, I saw you at breakfast. And he came to offer me some help. And 2 days later, he took me to a place called Donwood, which was, we didn't have treatment centers, but this was a hospital that Dr. Bell had started. And it was kind of a half-assed 12-step, excuse me. It was half hospital and therapy and all that kind of stuff, and it suited me. I hated God and I hated AA, and if you had tried to pawn that stuff on me, I don't know what I would have done. I needed to be there. You know, they cleaned me up. They taught me a few things, and then when I left, they gave me, because I had nothing and I had no home. And I sure was not going to go home to Saskatchewan, because my mother said at one point, you know, you can come home provided you don't drink and carry on and come home at 7 o'clock in the morning with our banker, who's a married man. This is not good. And so I couldn't live without, you know, I couldn't live under those, so I didn't even think of calling home. So I went to Skid Row. I want to tell you a little bit about that, because Skid Row taught me a few things. I got a higher power. I got a higher power actually when I was in Dawnwood, because he had two legs. He was a psychiatrist, not my husband, the other guy. He was the chief of psychiatry at Dawnwood, and he took an interest in me. And he said, you come, because he knew where I was, and he knew that I didn't know about Skid Row and all this. I just went, when I saw that room, I was going to be in for a whole year. And he said to me, you go get a job. I think I was broken, so I couldn't have had a teaching job or a responsible job. I went and knocked on one door after the other till I found a man who said, I've got a factory. And he said, if you want to come, you can sweep the factory floor every day. And that's what I did day after day after day. And my hope, my higher power was at Dawnwood. I went to see him once a week. And he'd tell me I was okay and I was going to be okay. I can't tell you how, like my husband was, he was off in the boonies, and there were days when there was no food in the fridge. And I was raised in a family that said, you made it, you lie in it. So I didn't go ask for help. And I got through it. Some days it was a potato. I remember one day standing with 40 cents in my hand. This was 1970, it was now, yeah, 73. And I wanted to go into this place. At that time, you could get a cup of coffee and a lemon tart for 40 cents. Can you imagine that? And do I do that, or do I go and buy some potatoes so that at least there's some food at home? I don't feel sorry for myself. It was a wonderful experience. It was the start of the stripping that had to take place. Because, you know, as I've been doing some review to do this talk, I see how stubborn I was. And then 6 months, and I wasn't going to AA. Who wants to go to that stupid place? One day I was in the institution, and a man said to me, will you come with me to a meeting? I didn't know where we were going. Nobody'd invited me lately, so off we went to an AA meeting. And you know what I remember of that was people seemed happy. They seemed to like each other. They seemed friendly. And I was so alone, so alone. I remember walking the streets of Toronto thinking, nobody knows me. And nobody cares that I'm here. I could just drop over in the ditch and I'm done. And they seemed, I liked that. I thought maybe I could someday be part of that. And then the magic was they said I should come back. Whoa, I didn't have pretty clothes and my hair were knocked out and all kinds of, no, my teeth were knocked out, not my hair. See, you got me all riled up. It's your fault. So I came to AA. My first sponsor got drunk. And then it was March, and we have a big conference in March. And they took me to this conference. And guess who was the speaker? Clancy. I remember we sat in the third row, and if you were up on a kind of a high stage, and I remember looking up at God, and I laughed like I think I had never laughed in my life before. My sides hurt, my gut hurt, and I loved every minute of it. And then I heard him say the magic words. He was talking of much, you know, some of the things I presume that he spoke of last night. And then he talked about step three, I think. And he said, you take actions that you don't believe in. Excuse me? That's what I took home, Clancy. And that contributed to the saving of my life. Because that first sponsor got drunk, there were two guys at my group who said, you have to do the steps. And I said, I can't do the step. I can't read anymore. And they said, we'll read. And they did. They read the book to me, and we did the steps. And when we got to step three, I said, I don't want to talk about that God. But I said, remember what Clancy said, I need to do things that I don't believe in. I'm grateful to you, Clancy, you know that. Been a big part of my life. And so they said, okay, if that's the case, get out the pencil and paper. And I did my fourth. And then before I did the fifth, I got that idea that you're not my problem, you know, what Bill says in step 10. It's a spiritual axiom. If I'm disturbed, I'm the one in error. The world rolls off your back when you understand that. And a whole lot of stuff can start to change. And then a man came to my group. I needed a sponsor. And he had size 16 shoes, metaphorically speaking. And he was not interested in how I felt. And I just had a sense that I would do what he told me to do, because that was still ringing in my head. Take actions that you don't believe in. I don't know how to do this life sober. Never done it sober before. And so I asked him to be my sponsor. And it was an interesting experience, because at that time, I wanted to talk theology. And he said, I don't give a damn about your theology. We have things that we have to do. And so he took me through the steps again. And when we got to step three, that nasty made a decision to turn my... I still don't like... that wording still doesn't say it for me. And so he said, I'm going to be your higher power. And you let me tell you, and I trusted him. And he gave me the directions, and that's how I lived that pretty well the first 20 years. I just couldn't come to terms with this God. You know, when you have got going inside you, what I had going inside you, it takes a lot of living and a lot of stripping. And so, in that 20 years, I was an active member of AA. I loved the program. I loved my home group. I sponsored people. I had a sponsor, and I was actively involved with this sponsor. I got a teaching job again, because that's what I do. I'm a high school college teacher. And I had to deal with the world sober. I didn't know how to do relationships, and he guided me through that. And he made me pay off my debts, and he made me do the amends. And he made me regarding the men. No, he didn't. I could do that stubbornly all by myself. But he did give me some guidance about how to handle myself in relationships. Not that I took that guidance very well. But 20 years, and by that time I was speaking at conferences. I don't think I ever really want to hear those tapes or whatever. But then I guess the people that were listening, they were 20 years, ago too. So anyway, I'm sober 20 years, and this man I'd had a relationship with, we said goodbye. And at 21 years, I gave up my job, and I didn't feel good inside. Those old messages from childhood were still going on in here. And one day I thought, you know, suicide wouldn't be such a bad deal. I felt so empty. And I had another spiritual experience, and I won't go into that except to say I knew it would be all right. And I made up my mind I was going to behave as if I still had a job. That was a powerful decision, and thank goodness for that sponsor. And 3 weeks later, I get a call out of the blue from Father O'Brien, a Jesuit. See, what I'm saying is, all this stuff, I still was not right with God. And he called and he said, you know, I'd like you to come and give a retreat. I'd never met him. He'd never seen me. He said, I know about you. And he said, I'd like you to come and give a retreat. Well, I needed to be there more than they needed me. It was 70 women. And, you know, even at that point, I wasn't enamored of women. The last talk that I did that Sunday morning, I started to bawl. I don't cry in front of women. I know how to shed a strategic tear or two with men, but I would never let myself bawl in front of women, and I bawled. It just was there. And I said, I don't have a friend in the world. And something happened. That was the truth. I had shut my family out. I had shut everybody out. You know, paste the face on and pretend that you're doing whatever, but inside you're dying. And, you know, I was helpless to change all that. And I believe I had to go through every single thing I had to go through to get to that morning. And I can tell you, I never felt so stripped in my life to stand there, and the walls just came down. I had no defenses left. It was out. I don't know how to do friendship, and I have never let you folks in. People used to say, you intimidate me. I thought it was a compliment. That's how sick I was. That was the start of the next piece of growth in my life. How can you grow when you're constantly pretending? How can you grow? How can you let God in? You see, I had identified with you as alcoholics and as addicted people, but I had not identified with you as people. I'm different. You don't understand me. And that morning, it was all taken away. I was just one soul among souls. And it was amazing. And it was amazing to me, the goodness of those women, how they surrounded me, and how they got it. And they were part of the change that came about in me. I started to do things different. I started to be able to take another look at that, at step three. See, I don't think it's possible to get right with God if I don't get right with you. If I'm shoving you out because you're not me, and, you know, as Chuck used to say, you think you're separate and that's your problem. You know who else said that? It was Einstein. He said, there's only one of us here. You're me and I'm you. And so when I shut you out, what do I do to myself, you see? So the process of healing had started really big time. And one day I was at a conference, and a man talked about the bondage of self. And my ears went up, because what he said, I identified with. He talked about the fact that he was, I think, 24 years sober at the time, and I think maybe I was 25. And he talked about the fact that he had started a business, and it just hadn't taken off. And he said various things that he had attempted to do. He said there was just something holding him back. And then he began to realize what it was. It was some old belief systems from childhood that he had never really taken note of, that he had listened to, that he had never given the lie to realize, when you say, nobody cares about me, I'm not okay, I'm not worthy, what are we saying? If God shows up as me, how dare I say that? And I got the message. And he had gone to somebody to learn how to deal with this, and I went to that person, and I'm telling you, I came back and my energy was different. My sponsor said, "Where in the name of God have you been?" Because instead of firing 20 cylinders, I was firing on 60. I was on fire with life. And so that's where this thing has taken, this experience of being in AA. The one thing I've always done right, I never left you. I have always had a home group. I have always been active in that group. I've always sponsored. I always read the book, whether it made sense to me or not. And that's what made, I believe, some healing possible. You know, think about what the book says. I mean, I know that service we have to do for others. I know what, you know, that we have to be of service to others. But what is the fire in my belly that is motivating that service? Is it that I'm going to feel good? Or is it about something deeper? And what I believe now is that God shows up as me. And God shows up as you. And so in the morning when I get up, I remind myself, I think about step one and the fact that I'm an alcoholic and I can't use the wrong solutions. And the way I lived, alcohol was the wrong solution. And I remind myself, I'm not the boss here, you see, because if God shows up as you, I'm certainly not in the middle of the 6.5 billion. And so I understand how that compulsion was taken away. There was nobody in the room. I believe there's a power bigger than me, and it's a good power. Today I can call it God. Why else does he say we've been rocketed into the fourth dimension? To me, the rest of my life is learning how to live in the fourth dimension, how to grow in that dimension and enjoy being in that dimension and having a good time and being of service. You know, and he says it all, doesn't he, in page 164, where he says, see to it that your relationship with God is right, and great things will come to pass for you and countless others. For me to think back to the kind of person I was and to know today that my heart is open, great things have come to pass, and whatever else needs to come to pass will, if that is the... And so, while I believe step three is the beginning that from which we move to do what we need to do, it's also a way of seeing the world. Get out there this today, Mildred, and let God use you to speak the words that he needs to have spoken and to love the people that he needs to love and to behave the way you should behave so that you bring the energy of goodness into the planet instead of what I brought before. And to every one of you, I owe you. I owe this organization, I owe God, I owe many of you speakers who have had such an important impact on my life, and to many of you, God bless you, I love you.